liability, bankruptcy, malpractice, and toxic torts. He talks about who the people are, why they got into the law, what seems to drive them, how they work in the courtroom, and also about this kind of law. It is a fascinating view into what it's like to be an attorney, the kind of battles that go on in the courtroom, and how they plan for, prepare for their cases. And if there is one thing that these people seem to have in common, it seems to be the thrill of the combat in the courtroom. And I just, before we start here, I want to share with you just a brief quote from one of the attorneys, this one, one from Houston. His name is Steve Sussman, that I think says it. He says, there's winning and there's losing. When you do deals, when you write wills, you aren't winning and losing. You're finishing jobs. But there's no sense of victory or defeat that you get in trial work. It's part of the competition, the game. That's it. It's the battle, the confrontation with the other lawyers in court coming out ahead. I love the battle. You're always on the line and you're always out front. The book is just recently out. Again, the publisher is Doubleday, and the author, John Jenkins, is talking with us this morning. Mr. Jenkins has been writing about the law for some time. He began his career as a legal affairs reporter, covering Capitol Hill, the Justice Department, the Federal Trade Commission, and the Securities and Exchange Commission. He's a regular contributor to the New York Times Magazine. His articles have also appeared in the Washington Post and the American Lawyer. His legal writing has four times earned him the American Bar Association Certificate of Merit, which is one of the highest honors in legal journalism. And he's joining us this morning by a telephone. Mr. Jenkins, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be with you, David.
It is a very interesting book, and I think it offers a view into what it's like in the courtroom, the business of preparing for trials that I think... And it gives you a better understanding what it is all about. And to most people, I'm sure, like a lot of professions, the law is a bit of a mystery, and you don't often get this kind of a glimpse into what it's really all about.
Well, you know, it was interesting that you used the quote from Steve Sussman at the beginning of your show, because since the book has been out, just in the month or two since it's been out, Sussman has really taken center stage in a way that he hadn't even when I wrote this. He was the counsel for Jim Wright in the Speaker, the mm-hmm. former Speaker Jim Wright. As Wright tried to keep his seat, he hired Sussman. I mean, he hired a guy that I call in the book a gunslinger of the law. And ultimately, I suppose Sussman wasn't too successful, but. On the other hand, it's part of the nature of the beast for a guy like Sussman is that he gets called in when you have your back to the wall. He's the guy you call.
That's just the phrase I sort of had in my mind. These people that you write about in this book, when you're really in trouble, these are the kinds of people that you call.
Well, because they stop at nothing to win.
Yeah. It seems that they have the kind of reputation that just having them as your attorney is going to give you a leg up.
Sure. You know, I mean, people say the same thing about divorce lawyers, some of the divorce lawyers that make their reputation. And then once they've made it, frequently all you have to do is hire them, and simply a call from the other side, a call from that lawyer, will provoke the settlement that you couldn't previously get. There are two Illinois lawyers in this book, in the litigators. One of them is Phil Corboy of Chicago, and the other is Rex Carr of East St. Louis, and he lives in Belleville. And, you know, they both, as I was talking to both of them and spending time with both of them, each time that I was in one of the offices, they got a phone call, or they had a client who couldn't get satisfaction, who couldn't get his case settled. And they went, in one case, the client went to Phil Corboy, and in the space of 2 hours, Corboy got a multi-million dollar settlement for which he charged another lawyer who had hired him. Another lawyer brought in Corboy. He charged that lawyer, I think it was $20,000, and he said that he worked 4 hours and he made $5,000 an hour. That's the attraction to these guys. They make more money. They're really a hidden industry of the law. But they make more money as plaintiff's lawyers than they could ever possibly make working for an hourly wage, working by the hour, which is how most lawyers work. These guys don't work by the hour, by the way. They get a percentage of the take. A lot of people don't realize that that's how plaintiffs' lawyers work. They make from anywhere from one-third to half of whatever they can get back for a client, plus expenses.
Now, of course, then, too, what people don't understand is, or might not think about is, while they think about these guys as being big money makers, they do work on this what is called a contingency fee basis, which means that if their client, if they lose, they don't get anything. If the damage award for some reason is very small, and they've end up spending more out of their pocket in the process of preparing and doing the trial, it's out of their pocket. And there are cases where they have represented clients where they the attorney has ended up losing a lot of money because they lost the case.
It does happen. It doesn't happen as frequently as people might think. It doesn't happen as frequently as these plaintiff's lawyers would like you to think it happens. Hmm. I talked to somebody when I was writing the book who told me that they are they're very good at smelling out the losers and not taking them. You know, they don't have to take every case that comes to them.
How much money do they make? Is that something that you were able to discover?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I mean, a lot of them weren't happy that I discovered it. By the way, Sussman is the only lawyer that I wrote about that's still talking to me after this. And I think it's just because Sussman is the only one I found out from someone else who actually hasn't read the book. not that the book is overly critical. It is critical of these lawyers in some sense. It also finds things to praise in each of them, I think. But one of the things that I did, and they weren't necessarily happy about it in many cases, was to be able to discover how much they made. I think Phil Corboy made anywhere from $3.5 million to probably $6 or $7 million in the last year that figures were available. That'd probably be now 77. Steve Sussman, when I first met him, he was making $1 million a year. He was one of the few people that told me how much he made. He was making $1 million a year. When the book came out, right before it went to press, we were able to update it. He was making $2 million a year. One of the reasons I wrote this book, people think that, there is an aura about the shortstop that makes $2 million a year. The concert pianist or the movie star that gets $3 million a movie, and their names are household names. And yet, you've got when I set out to write the litigators, you know what I realized was these guys, the litigators, are making as much as these household names in other fields, and yet nobody knows who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Rex Carr, the other lawyer from Illinois. There wasn't a year that I knew him or wrote about him that he wasn't making $1 million a year, although he's, I think, maybe having some hard times now because of some other things that I describe in the book. But anyway, it's fascinating. Virtually everyone's making over $1 million a year, in some cases well in excess of $1 million a year, all off of the contingent fee. Maybe your listeners will have some comments about whether they think anybody that is representing a victim of a horrible, horrible accident should be able to profit that much from somebody else's misfortune. But the reality is it's happening.
Yeah. That, I guess, is the certainly many people do not hold the legal profession in high esteem. But if you're going to sort of say that there are good lawyers and bad lawyers, I guess some people would say that those lawyers who do make their money off the misfortune of others, people who do personal injury stuff, people who do often the family law, divorce stuff, they'll say that they're the worst for that reason, because they're saying here they're making their living off of the suffering of these folks.
Well, let me tell you, I mean, that's a good point. Let me give you one example that I write about in the book. In Rex Carr's firm, there is another lawyer that had a very good case as plaintiff's lawyer. And he made that case. I mean, others had the case and hadn't been able to do anything with it. And this fellow in Carr's firm made it. He also had a 40% contingent fee. nobody complained. This is why, just to back up for a minute, I mean, somebody once said that my book should have been subtitled The Good, the Bad, and the Mildly Reprehensible. You know, nobody complained when they signed up for this 40% contingency. They were glad to have a good lawyer taking their case. Well, nobody ever believed that he would get as much money as he did for him. He did, and there then was filed in court a motion to reduce the contingent fee because it was unconscionable. A lot of lawyers would agree that that fee, that 40% fee, was unconscionable. But the guy that got the money said, you know, there wasn't one of these clients that turned that money down when we paid him. Yeah. And so, you know, I think it's the contingent fee is something that really needs a lot more debate than it gets. It's a very little known element, I think, of the legal system. And it ought to be looked at a lot more closely. It ought to be the subject of true arm's length negotiating between client and lawyer, and it is not. And as I wrote The Litigators, you know, that's one of the things that I feel very strongly about, that there are abuses that are not being addressed, and I think that it's you can't let the legal profession regulate itself. Somebody else has to go in and deal with it.
Well, these lawyers, if they, as they talk about, in particular, the business of their fees and what they do for people, mm-hmm. will they try to tell you that they are performing some kind of public service, or will they be honest with you and say, I'm in this because I can make a whole lot of money?
Some of them are honest. Rex Carr is very honest in saying the incentive of one-third of the take is what makes me do my job. Some of them will try to tell you, but I think it certainly with me, it falls on deaf ears. Some of them will try to tell you that they are acting in the public interest. Of course, that is the way these plaintiff's lawyers need to characterize it in order to keep the government regulation off their backs. Some states have imposed caps on contingent fees in certain kinds of cases, like malpractice cases. California has a cap on contingent fees, for instance. But very few states have such regulation. More states ought to have it.
We're talking this morning with John Jenkins. He's author of the book, The Litigators, Inside the Powerful World of America's High-Stakes Trial Lawyers. And we'd be happy to have some questions. In fact, I have somebody right here on our toll-free line that'd like to talk with us. The local number is 333-9455. And the toll-free, 800-222-9455. We will bring this person right into our conversation. Hello.
Hi, David. Mm-hmm. I don't want to beat a dead horse here too much, but I think it's very important to point out a couple of things that your guest said. One of the original things that he said was that these guys will do anything, whatever it takes to win, and I myself find that a little bit disturbing, and also the motivation for them is the money. And does he not see that as a huge problem, as opposed to some other legal systems in other countries where the motivation is to get to the truth? But here, that may be a little bit idealist, but I think it's a problem when we have guys that are making millions of dollars and doing whatever it takes, quote unquote, to get that millions of dollars. And also, I think it's important to point out that we are a nation of lawyers, and these are some of the same people that are writing our laws day after day. And so, what are their motivations there? Do they change at all when they move from one sector into another sector?
I think that guest makes a an excellent point. That caller makes an excellent point when he talks about money being the motivating factor. Let me give you an example. In the Steve Sussman chapter, to go back to the lawyer that also was the guy who represented Jim Wright, he represented the Hunt brothers. The Hunt brothers had a debt of $1.5 billion to 22 banks. They couldn't pay it because of their own stupidity and their own failure to manage their business. Instead of mortgaging the assets that they did have and paying the bank off, they hired Sussman, who came up with a novel idea. Sue the banks. Why? Because the banks should never have loaned the money to the brothers to begin with, because they should have known that the brothers couldn't pay it back. They should have known that the brothers were bad risks. That's a classic example of kind of a lawyer's argument that doesn't hold any water. I think thank goodness it also didn't hold any water in court, because ultimately the brothers did have to pay the money back, and Sussman's ploy didn't work. But what he did was get valuable time. He bought valuable time for the hunts, in which they could have, if other circumstances had come around, they could have paid the money back. It's a very good example of how the greed factor makes us do things that are something other than getting at the truth in a court of law. I forget if the listener is still there. I forget the last point that he made.
The other point was that so many of our legislators today are lawyers, and if they're not, a lot of the times they themselves are not working on legislation, on the actual laws, and their staff members who are lawyers are doing that, or they're doing it themselves. And it does that change at all? Is that motivation still sometimes money, and is that maybe part of the problem, all this hoopla we're seeing now with ethics, et cetera?
It's a kind of fox in the hen house mentality, isn't it? But it's interesting. You would think that having the fox in the hen house would lead to laws that really didn't make sense. But very frequently, and I haven't studied. I'm not a scholar. I'm a writer and a reporter, and I haven't really pondered this too much. But it's interesting to look at what is happening in the states around the country, where caps on contingent fees and on malpractice judgments are being put in place. You know, those malpractice caps I have some problem with in some cases, because I think that they may go too far the other direction. But the point is that there are state legislatures and I suppose the national, the Congress as well, who do listen. Ultimately, they listen to their constituents, because the constituents vote with the ballot box. And I don't really have any evidence, although maybe there are some other people out there that can enlighten me, that having the lawyers in the legislature have led to laws that are worse than we ought to have. I do think, though, as I said earlier, we let lawyers regulate themselves too much. We leave it to the bar to do things that frequently the legislator ought to do, and I do think there's a problem there.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
Thanks.
I'd like to talk in a bit of detail about some of the attorneys that you profile in the book. In your first section, you write about Mort Galane, and who was an attorney who represented Wayne Newton, the singer, who sued NBC for libel. He ended up winning and secured for his client the largest award of damages ever that had been ever against a news organization, although I'm not sure Wayne Newton hasn't actually collected any of this.
He hasn't collected a cent. Interesting case. A lot of people read that chapter and have to chuckle at the kind of lawyer that Wayne Newton hired. He is the antithesis of what you would think one of the most winningest lawyers in the country would be. He's kind of a nerdy, funny, very craggy man in Las Vegas who went up against one of the best First Amendment lawyers in the country, a guy by the name of Floyd Abrams from a big firm in New York. And Mort Galane just cleaned his clock, got almost a $20 million verdict. You're right, Newton hasn't collected anything. It has been since reduced. Galane was so successful. He was too successful. Because that award attracted so much attention, it was reduced by the trial judge down to around $5 million. And they're still trying to collect the $5 million. NBC is not going to pay one penny, although I think at one point they offered to settle it for its nuisance value, which was about $100,000. They're well beyond that point now.
What really struck me about this guy and this case, the fact that, Abrams, Floyd Abrams, the lawyer you mentioned, was an East Coast guy, I'm sure very elegant, very... maybe almost professorial.
Every sentence parses perfectly.
Kind of guy. And he blamed his loss on the fact that it was a hometown jury. The case was tried in Las Vegas, and Wayne Newton, of course, was a Las Vegas guy. And he said, that was the problem. But it what seemed to be the case was that Abrams really was completely out of touch with the jury, and that Galane was. He knew how to talk to those individuals, and it was... he managed to make this very personal kind of communication with the jury, and that's why he won.
Right on the money. Floyd Abrams said to me, "You know, I thought I was winning right up until they came back with a verdict." He thought he won it. And, you know, another funny thing, the reporters that were covering that case also thought he won.
Yeah.
Ghislaine was the only one who knew he was going to win.
Is that ability to connect with jurors, you think, something that many of these attorneys have in common?
Well, it's in the book, you know, certainly it's what these six lawyers that I wrote about have in common. The ability to read a jury, to know, to intuitively be able to, you know, in a different business, in television, there is, I think, a phrase sometimes used by directors on the talent that's on TV, you know, the camera loves her or the camera loves him.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that these people have this special, what Corboy called an X factor. You can't define it. But they have this special charisma that comes through, even when you're sitting in the jury box. Clearly, at least five of the six lawyers had it. There's one lawyer in this book whose name is John Cole. We might talk about him a little bit later, who's very much an ambulance-chasing kind of lawyer. He doesn't try jury cases. He's in the book for a reason, because he's emblematic of another kind of trial lawyer. But he doesn't really try cases. So I can't say that he has that same simpatico with the jury that the other guys do, but clearly it's something that's crucial to winning. And Sussman, to get back to the Houston lawyer, you know, Sussman, there's a certain element of acting, a certain element of trying to get down to the juror's level, to the common man's level, and try to react with him. And Sussman said to me, you know, I try to be folksy. He was criticized in a review of this book in the Wall Street Journal. Sussman was criticized for saying that he was trying to be folksy. He was trying to be one of the boys, when in fact he was really a pinstripe knight. But it's the reality, and Sussman was being honest.
We'll talk with John Jenkins some more in just a moment here. We're talking about his book, The Litigators: Inside the Powerful World of America's High-Stakes Trial Lawyers. John Jenkins is our guest. He wrote the book, as published by Doubleday. Just before we took a break there, you mentioned John Cole, and I'd like to talk a little bit about him. He's an interesting character. This is the fellow, he was riding along, I think, was in a cab?
He was in a taxi cab in Washington.
And he heard on the radio the story about Bhopal, and he had never done this kind of stuff before. He had been representing people who had been arrested for driving under the influence, and had never done this mass disaster kind of stuff, which is the sort of the exclusive province of a lot of big attorneys who try very hard to keep it to themselves. But he decided he was going to get on a plane and go, which he did. The bottom line was, he really never made any money out of that, but it made his name.
That was
his entry into this field of mass disaster law.
John Cole was a courthouse hustler, and he was taking the avenue of least resistance, which to making his money, which was it was the closest thing to ambulance chasing you could do and still not be guilty of it. He was standing in front of the courthouse, handing out his card, saying, "If you've been charged with drunk driving, I'm your man." And he found that people in that situation were desperate for a lawyer and would do anything for somebody that they thought could get them off. What they didn't realize was that he had this assembly line method that he knew what a plea for drunk driving was worth in those days, and he, without much effort, he could get people what they probably could have gotten themselves if they had only known enough to do it. I'm sitting here making a connection as you tell me this, back the story of John Cole, that in fact the path of least resistance was what he took in Bhopal and its progeny. He found out that he reckoned correctly that he could make tremendous amount of money settling disaster cases and never would have to take them to trial. That every disaster case, virtually every disaster case that John Cole is involved in, has a couple of common elements. There's a deep pocket on the other side. There's a party that is almost certainly guilty of causing the accident. If you're a passenger in an airplane you didn't cause, you couldn't have contributed at all to that plane going down. It wasn't your fault. There's a deep pocket, an insurance company or an airplane company that will pay big money to keep this case out of court. And Cole knew that, and he started signing up cases. And he didn't do very well in Bhopal. He didn't make any money, although he found some lawyers that paid his expenses back, which was not an insignificant amount of money. I think it was close to $100,000. He has since gone on to make millions in other cases. A lot of people don't like what John Cole stands for, and I don't much like what John Cole stands for either. There's a John Cole doesn't much like what I've written about him in The Litigators, but the fact is that he's the kind of guy that the legal profession has to deal with, and they're not dealing with the John Coles of the world. They haven't the trial lawyers that police themselves have many people like this in their ranks. And in fact, some of the best-known lawyers that I write about in this chapter, including Melvin Belli, are of that ilk. They are chasing cases. They don't really try them. If they try them, they don't do well. Melvin Belli is in this book as someone trying cigarette cases, which I hope we get a chance to talk about a little bit later. But there's some problems with these kind of guys.
And no, has anybody that you wrote about in this book threatened to sue you yet?
I've gotten some letters, but nobody's threatened to sue me. The book is true. I mean, the book is an inside look at what the legal profession and plaintiff's lawyers are all about. Nobody's threatened to sue. Some people haven't been real happy with it. I've gotten a couple of nasty phone calls left on my answering machine, I'm sorry to say. But I've also had a lot of people in this profession call me up, and some very well-known lawyers and some people who wouldn't ever want to say this publicly call me up and say, thank God you wrote this thing.
We could talk. Let's talk a little bit about the tobacco cases. You also write about another attorney. Is Mark? Is it Edel?
Mark Edel.
Edel.
Hard E.
When he got into this was into this particular case, and it's one that got a lot of national attention. He was pretty young. He was a cocky guy. It seems like he thought that there was a lot of money to be made, but he was going into a case where into a kind of case that nobody had ever won before. The tobacco companies had been sued many times by some celebrated attorneys and had never lost. What made him think that he could win?
Well, let me tell you, David, when I first met Mark Edel, I didn't like him. He is very cocky. That's the answer to your question, what made him think he can win. He just knew he could win. Uh-huh. But he's a very cocky guy, and he really rubbed me the wrong way. And he maybe didn't like me very much either. We're the same age, and we come from very very different backgrounds. And I suppose he viewed what I was doing as maybe infringing on his turf, and I picked up on that instantly. And maybe he was suspicious of what the book was going to be all about. I came in time to admire this courageous, relatively young man. He's 38 years old. He took on, almost single-handedly, because he spent $2 million of his law firm's money, and in the end, they were not giving him any more resources. He was trying the case by the seat of his pants by the time it finally came to trial. He spent millions of dollars of his and his law firm's money. He did not earn the fees and the salary that he could have earned if he hadn't taken this case, but he went forward with it. Not entirely altruistic. He has a lot of other cases in the wings, and he hopes to eventually make some money on these cases. So he was motivated by money. But, you know, we get back to the listener's comment earlier on money being the motivating factor. No question it was for Mark Edel. No question about it. And yet he did something that, to my way of thinking, was extremely important. He put the first chink in the armor of the cigarette companies. He won a very small but nonetheless important victory. I think it was $50,000 verdict against the cigarette companies. And now they can no longer say, thanks to Mark Edel, nobody's ever beaten us.
Yeah. It was perhaps not a big monetary victory, but a moral victory.
It was a huge moral victory, and it could be a monetary victory for Edel. But anyway, there's a good example of a guy who, it's a victory, yes, but really a defeat in the sense that he didn't even get his, he didn't go anywhere near getting his expenses on this case back. That part of the litigators could have been a book in itself, I think. It probably goes on for a better part of 100 pages. And Mark is really center stage in that, although Melvin Belli, it was very important to Belli to get the publicity of being the first person in the 1980s to sue the cigarette companies, and he put on a terrible case out in Santa Barbara and lost it badly, probably set the cause back some years. He and Edel are the antithesis of each other, Belli being about an 82-year-old curmudgeon and Edel being the brash 38-year-old who was sent away to military school because his parents couldn't control him.
That's very interesting. I have several callers here. We'd like to talk with them. We have about 15 minutes left, too. We're talking with John Jenkins, the author of the book, The Litigators. We'll go to the phones here. We'll go to the toll-free line first. Hello?
Mr. Jenkins?
Yes?
I'm having a difficult time understanding your logic. If I had a personal injury and went to Philip Corboy, now he would put all the circumstances that of investigative techniques and expenses such as photography and all the uses of these sophisticated techniques that John Smith down the block wouldn't have the money to advance. That's why the contingency thing is so important. And I think it's you know, and as far as a client is concerned, it's possibly a very good thing.
Well, you know, don't get me wrong. I think that the contingent fee is not necessarily a bad thing, but I would couple of points that I think need to be made. First of all, Philip Corboy will take your case if you have a case that's worth him taking. If you follow that logic, Phil Corboy turns down 95% of the people that come to him and want him to take their case because they're not hurt badly enough for Corboy to justify spending the time. They can't get him the kind of contingent fee award that he needs in order to make his $3.5 million. That's unfortunate. That's unfortunate for most people because they can't make use of a guy like Phil Corboy. The second point is that you say that Corboy needs this big contingent fee in order to do a thorough investigation. That's not true, necessarily. In the case of the disaster lawyers we were just talking about, they earn a third to a half of the judgment for doing very little in most cases because those cases are going to settle anyway. And I suppose if you were going to really truly reward a guy like Phil Corboy, what you should do is reward him on the difference between what you thought he could get you and what you thought John Smith down the street could get you, because in some cases it isn't a whole lot different. And people don't know that. But my problem with the contingency isn't that it exists, because I think that it's appropriate to exist in some cases. My problem with it is that when you look at a case where one guy has signed up 40 clients and he's making each of them pay 33 1/3%, and he's getting a judgment that's going to provide him with $5 or $10 million fee for doing not much more for the 40 people than he would have had to have done for one, I don't think that's right. And I think that, you know, I don't care what anybody else says, I don't think it's right, and I think that the legislator ought to do something about it.
Let's take another caller here, line one. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
Hello, hi. I wonder, if these men are seemingly so reprehensible, why is it, I guess, that the American Bar Association, that's the name of the professional society, right?
Mm-hmm.
The ABA is the trade association.
Why don't they police themselves? It seems that these guys literally are getting away with, you know, morally, ethically, whatever you want to call it, reprehensible things. And I'm sure there's others like them, but it seems that they're getting away with it, you know, knowingly. I think someone probably knows, but I guess my question is, why isn't their professional organization policing themselves?
I'll tell you a funny story. John Cole, the guy that went to Bhopal, There is it's a story about John Cole. There's an association called the Association of Trial Lawyers of America. I write about it in the book. It's the trade association for plaintiff's lawyers. If you're not a plaintiff lawyer, you can't belong. They didn't like what John Cole was doing in Bhopal and all the other cases he was involved in. Truly didn't like it. Truly felt that he was giving all their members a black eye. They wanted to throw him out of their association. They wanted to publicly discipline him. Problem. He's not a member because it's a voluntary trade association. So they gave him a temporary, you know, sometimes for marketing purposes, associations will send you things and they'll say you'll be a member for the next 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
It was a transparent thing and it was really actually very funny.
They made him a member so they could then throw him out?
They made him a member so they could throw him out. And John Cole is such a bad boy and such a is just such a character. He called me up and he said, they're going to take my deposition. They've made me a member. I'm not a member, but they've put me back into membership, and they've sent a man over who's with a court reporter. They're going to swear me as a witness and try to take my deposition, and I'm going to do it just for the hell of it, and why don't you come over, Jenkins, and see this? And I went over, and I wrote about it in the book, and it was kind of funny. But ultimately, it was this Keystone Cops thing that the trade association tried to police him, tried to kick him out, and they didn't have they couldn't do it because they're just a voluntary association, and that's my point. You know, we can't let these lawyers regulate themselves. I don't say that everything that these guys do in the book is bad. I mean, Mark Edel, for example, was in it for the money, but he did everybody a tremendous service by getting the first judgment against the tobacco companies. Every one of these lawyers has some of those things in their background that make them good people. But the problem is, you know, when you can't differentiate the good from the bad, I think that's the problem. And the ABA is also simply a trade association. They're not in a position to discipline their members. They're in a position to advance the interests of their members.
Hmm. Let's go to another call, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
They can disbar a person, though. I mean, that's toothless, or is that what you're saying?
Well, the disbarment what you have to do if you're a lawyer in order to get disbarred, as far as I can tell, is be convicted of a crime. I don't know when the last time a lawyer was disbarred for doing what these guys do in collecting fees and getting people to sign retainer agreements, because every lawyer, including John Cole, I was with him when he went to try to sign up a client who had been hit by a speedboat in Pittsburgh. If you remember, there was a regatta in Pittsburgh. A boat went out of control. It ran into the crowd, and John Cole wanted to he wanted to extend his dominion from the air to water. And so I went up there with him. He signed up a bunch of clients. What he's doing is legal. That's the problem. Under the law, it is legal. He has a signed contract. He signs a person to a contingent fee. And he does everything within the letter, if not the spirit, of the law. Disbarments usually occur because a guy was convicted of raping a client or he stole money from the client. These men are not doing that. This is a much more nuanced kind of thing. And again, that's the problem that I have with it. You've got to have disciplinary bodies that can differentiate the good from the bad. And that really doesn't happen.
What's the likelihood of legislation? And then I'll just ask something that's probably going to be overruled as out of order. But do you have any Brendan Sullivan stories? And the first question is there any chance that there's any legislation? I would really like for somebody to talk about this whole Brendan Sullivan thing. There probably isn't time now, so I'll just hang up and listen.
Well, I tell you, the legislation there are, we talked about at the beginning of the show. There are some states that have put caps on contingent fees. California, in certain cases, divorce cases, which, by the way, you're allowed to have a contingent fee in divorce cases in California, terrible. Shouldn't happen. They finally capped it at 33 and a third in a divorce case. That means that divorce lawyers in Hollywood, somebody gets a $3 million judgment, their fee for very little work could be as much as $1 million. Some states are beginning to regulate how much of a fee can be charged and requiring lawyers to put in their contract with a client that what the maximum is. That's happening. That's constructive. I think that that's something that isn't constructive, frankly, is malpractice caps, malpractice award caps, which are frequently being turned to in states that are trying to stop high malpractice awards. I happen to think that that those are unfair to people who have been horribly injured, and I'm against them. But so there's good and there's bad happening in the legislative arena. Some of it's good. Brendan Sullivan, Fred don't have any stories for you, although if you've got any for me, I'll give you my phone number after the show.
Okay, let's go to another caller here on the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, it seems that lawyers are finding new ways to sue and anybody under the sun, and now it's turning on themselves, it seems. There's a new ruling where many states are now finding that lawyers are accountable under state consumer protection statutes, as well as extending it to racketeering laws. And in the New York Times last Friday, they brought out the fact that lawyers are now finding fair game among their own colleagues for suits. And with the proliferation of many lawyers, many of them taking on cases that they may not be equipped to handle, or saying they can take a case and turning it over to an associate who hasn't had an experience and then consequently losing out. Every client has a means to turn back upon this callous offhandedness that lawyers give their clients. I'm only thinking of Gary Spence recently. He's been on a talk show circuit and saying, I think the title of his book was Justice for None.
Yeah.
So this matter of having other avenues to pursue to get back at lawyers is opening up to triple damages in the case of using these racketeering aspects.
Some states are doing that. California has a very active program now in the that they've just begun. They had a state bar that was dead for years, and California now is trying to reinvigorate that, and they're trying to actively go after lawyers who abuse their clients in ways you've described. New York is another such state that is trying to do that. And you're right, you're talking about the RICO, the racketeering law. Yeah, I think that I just talked to a client last night of a lawyer who was unhappy with the result. He didn't do a good job for her. It's a case I was covering, and she's going to sue him under the. She's going to get what she didn't get in court through probably a malpractice award.
We just have a couple of minutes left. You did talk earlier about the fact that with one of these attorneys that it was somebody that you started out not liking, and perhaps you changed your mind somewhat.
Oh,
These guys, they don't come off very well in this book, some of them. Can you find anything to like about these people?
Oh, sure. First of all, you have to admire the hard work that they all put in to their cases. A guy like Phil Corboy is really a prince in that regard. He is the hardest working man in that firm, probably, and he is brilliant in the courtroom. Some of them are truly characters, and so they are. When you're a reporter, you're sometimes forced to put aside your likes and dislikes and sort of take a more detached air. And when you do that, you find that there are even John Cole has this lovable teddy bear type side to him that that almost makes you hate to say anything bad about him. Although I was able to, as you could see, put that aside in my book.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they all are doing excellent, getting excellent results for their clients. And if there's a bottom line, that's it. They have done excellent work for the people they've represented. I fault them because they don't represent most of the people that really need their help can't get it. But the people that they do represent always get the finest result that any lawyer could get. That's really the ultimate that you could say about them.
Yeah. It's a very interesting book. I appreciate you giving us some of your time to talk about it.
Oh, I'm glad to do it.
The book that we've been talking about is The Litigators, Inside the Powerful World of America's High-Stakes Trial Lawyers. It's published by Doubleday. It's just recently out, and the guest is John Jenkins.